Good evening, everyone. Good morning, wherever you are in the world. It's your host, Danny Hai Fong. Please hit the like button as you come on. As you can see, I am joined by Professor Jiang Shui-Qin. He is host of Predictive History. And what we're going to talk about is the countdown to the next Israel-Iran war. Round number two is soon upon us. It could be as soon as days away. Sources are saying that the next iteration of this conflict are going to be far bigger, and it could lead to a World War III scenario. And Professor Jiang is here to talk to us about how close we are to this unthinkable moment and the historical context that we need to know to help us understand not just the present, but the future to come. Professor Jiang, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Danny.
Great. Yes, it is great to be with you. Well, let's get right to it. Iran-Israel round two, there's been a lot of talk about that conflict, that war happening again very soon. The U.S. has been building up to the end of these, or to the reinstatement of these snapback sanctions with military deployments that are getting bigger in the region. And Netanyahu, on October 7th, is selling war already. And I just want to play this for all of you, just so you all can see how he is doing this, selling war against Iran. Here we go.
Iran is developing now ballistic missiles that are intercontinental ballistic missiles for 8,000 kilometer range. What does that mean? They add another 3,000 kilometers, and they've got under their gun, under their atomic guns, the New York City in target, Washington, Boston, Miami, Mar-a-Lago. Okay.
So Professor Jiang, he says all of this with a smile on his face. Talk to us about how close we are to round number two, Israel-Iran war, and how you come about making these kind of predictions as host of Predictive History.
Yeah, so I think that we're very close to the next Israel-Iran conflict. And as you say, everyone predicts that this conflict in the second iteration will be much worse, much more sustained, and it can draw in much more powerful forces. For example, Russia may be forced to be drawn into this conflict for its own geopolitical reasons. And we can expect that this war could last for a very long time. Last time there's a conflict, it was almost like a test run. It was only 12 days. But this time, it seems as though all the ingredients are in place for sustained war. So let's go over some of the ingredients. The first ingredient is the snapback sanctions. So the Europeans have said that, you know, we've tried our best to reach a compromise with the Iranians, but they are recalcitrant, they're stubborn, they refuse to give up their nuclear testing program, and therefore we are forced to impose sanctions. The Iranians have recently paid back all of their outstanding foreign debt obligations, and Iran has been removed from the SWIFT system. You also have a series of interlocking treaties that have appeared this past month. So, for example, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan have signed a mutual defense pact. If any of these nations are attacked, the other nation is obligated to come to its defense. The United States has signed an agreement with Qatar providing defense. Russia and Iran have signed an agreement as well. It's not a mutual defense pact. Russia is not obligated to come to Iran's defense if it is attacked, but Russia will provide other forms of support. And so what we're seeing almost is a replay of the months before World War I, the outbreak of World War I, when these nations had these interlocking treaties so that a small conflict, a regional conflict that appeared in Sarajevo quickly escalated to encompass all of Europe and most of the world. So I think a lot of ingredients are already in place for a massive escalation. It seems that whatever Iran does, the United States will see it as a provocation to attack Iran. If Israel attacks Iran, Iran will be forced to defend itself. And as a result, it will see all possible belligerents as targets. So Israel is a belligerent, but also we have to remember that the United States is enabling Israel by moving all these air tankers to the region, to Qatar. And so that enables Israel to do long distance strikes against Iran. So the United States is actively enabling Israel, and therefore Iran feels that it's empowered to attack U.S. bases in the region. But if it does that, then it would draw the United States into the war. If it's forced, Iran will close the Strait of Hormuz. If it closes the Strait of Hormuz, that's going to do tremendous damage to the entire global economy. Most of East Asia depends on the Strait of Hormuz for its oil. And so if the Strait of Hormuz is closed, the United States may be forced to send in ground troops in order to secure the Strait of Hormuz. And if it does that, then it's basically World War III. The United States is pot committed. It has to go all in now because there's ground troops in the region. It cannot extricate itself.
Yeah, and Professor Jung, Iran is saying that they have actually recovered. There's a lot of speculation about Iran's capabilities at this time. Many have said that Iran is weaker, that they took a lot of damage during the 12-day war, and that they are in no position to strike back at this time. But Iran is saying something different. The commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Aerospace Force has said that they have recovered from the 12-day war and are ready to respond with a fresh attack. And Iran has also said that it's not clear that they will be the ones who have to strike back. They might actually attack first if they feel compelled to. What do you make of this chatter? How do you see it?
Yeah, I think that the 12-day war, even though the Israelis did a lot of decapitation strikes, they killed a lot of nuclear scientists, they killed a lot of senior military officials, it seemed to Westerners as though it was a resounding success. But when you do that, what often happens is that the population rallies around the regime because everyone feels under threat. Also, I hate to say this, but when you actually remove some of the senior leadership, it actually makes the military much more vibrant, much more dynamic. The reason why is that you allow for much more vigorous, much more creative individuals to rise in the system. And by removing some of the ossified bureaucracy, it allows more for openness, for more innovation. So I think that you will have a much more dynamic, much more creative, energetic leadership at the top right now. If a second iteration were to happen, I think the population would be much more supportive of the regime. I think a lot of these internal divisions that were happening in Iran these past few years, they will sort of die out as the population recognizes that this is an existential struggle for the Persian civilization. The United States, Israel, they're coming in to destroy your civilization. They're not here for regime change. They're not here to impose a democratic regime. They're here to do what they did in Iraq, Libya, and Syria, which is to destroy your civilization. And so I think the people are much more unified. They're much more energetic. They're much more cohesive than before. Also, the Iranians probably learn a lot about Israeli and American capacities during the 12-day war. They know how the Israelis will go about fighting this war, and they know how America will support Israel. So the Iranians are able basically game theory out the scenario, and they're able now to develop much more effective countermeasures. Remember that the mainstream of the Iranian military are drones and intercontinental ballistic missiles. And what we saw in the 12-day war is that Israel cannot defend against Iranian ICBMs, especially hypersonics. The so-called Iron Dome, there's a lot of leakage in it. So Israel cannot possibly defend itself against a full Iranian strike. And so I think that the Iranian military is going into the second round with much more energy and much more confidence.
Yeah, well, you talked about game theory, and you also mentioned earlier World War III and others being pulled into this conflict. Do you see the Israel-Iran war as being the catalyst of a kind of a further development of a World War III scenario? And what would that exactly look like in your estimation, given that Israel already in the United States, Brown University just came out and said that the United States has spent $33 billion on the West Asia, Middle East wars that on behalf of Israel since October 7, 2023. Do you see this region? Do you see the Iran, you know, under fire, Iran being targeted for war as the catalyst for this World War III? And what does that look like? Because this could happen at any moment. Some are saying we're going to see this attack in October. Some are saying it's going to happen by the end of 2025. But it seems like there's enough desperation here on the part of the West, on the part of the U.S., on the part of Israel, for this to have some backing to it. What's your thoughts?
Right. So we have to remember that historically, the Middle East, Anatolia, the Levant, Mesopotamia, Persia, it's really the center of world civilization. It's a cradle of civilization. We think that, you know, the Middle East is rich with oil, and that is certainly true. But its main major geopolitical significance is the fact that it's a center of global trade. If you want to get from one place to another place around the world, you have to go through the Middle East. If you look at all the major trade linkages being proposed by different nations, it's all centered around the Middle East. So, for example, China has the Belt and Road Initiative, and Iran plays a very important role in that. But then you have the Russian North-South Corridor, and that runs through Iran as well. The Europeans have something called the IMAC, the I believe it's called the European Middle East India Corridor. So as you can see, in Eurasia, especially in Eurasia, Iran is the center of the world. So if it's able to control Iran, controls the entire Eurasian continent. And discussed, the Strait of Hormuz is an extremely strategic choke point because a lot of the world's oil runs through that very, very narrow passage controlled by Iran. If Iran were to cut off the oil supply, then the East Asian economies, China, Japan, Southeast Asia, would suffer greatly. So I don't see how if a conflict arises in the Middle East between Israel, United States, and Iran, I don't see how this could not engulf the entire world at some point. So that's the conundrum that the world faces. The center of the world is in the Middle East. If a conflict arises in the Middle East, global trade, global oil supply, it is severely hampered. And the world has to be drawn in at some point, whether it's militarily, politically, or economically.
Yeah, about 90% of Iran's oil goes to China in order to help develop the very trade routes through the Belt and Road Initiative that you just mentioned. And of course, Russia, there was a lot made about the fall of Syria and how that was a very confusing situation for many viewers here, actually. Why did Russia stand down? Why didn't Syria fight back? But this situation appears to be much different, Professor John, because Iran, as you said, is such a key player in the development of this almost post-West, post-Western civilizational order. Talk about this, because Israel is at the center of all of it. I mean, Israel is creating all of this havoc. What role does Israel play in disrupting this, and why is it that Israel gets carte blanche to do all of this, including ignite a war that might lead to a Samson option situation like one with Iran?
Yeah, so if you go back historically, we have to remember that Israel is a creation of the British Empire. And it's a creation of the British Empire initially to destabilize the Ottoman Empire, which was the main threat that the British face in the Middle East. Today, Israel has become the pit bull of the United States. Israel is basically a tool of American foreign policy. And American foreign policy is to destabilize the Middle East, because if you destabilize the Middle East, you just destabilize the entire Eurasian continent. Okay, so I'm sure your viewers understand something called the Mackinder thesis. And his argument is that Britain is first and foremost a naval power. It is not a land power. If Britain were to engage in a land war, then that would be disastrous for Britain, and it would lose a land war. Britain is first and foremost a naval power, and it will always control the world's seas. So the greatest threat to British imperialism, the greatest threat to British global dominance, is the unification of the Eurasian continent. If a great power were to emerge in the Eurasian continent, and it could have been Russia or Germany, then Britain would lose control of trade routes, because this Eurasian power could just easily build railways that connects the entire Eurasian continent and connects it to Middle East, Africa. And then Britain would go bankrupt. Its naval power would be negated. And so British foreign policy is first and foremost focused on fomenting discontent, on conflict in the Eurasian continent. And you can make the argument, and many people have made the argument, that Britain is responsible for many of the global conflicts that have occurred in the past 200 years, including World War I. And the reason why is Britain cannot afford for one great power to emerge in Eurasia. Now, Britain is no longer the great Pax Britannica, but now you're in the Pax Americana. In Pax Americana, their foreign policy follows very much the same logic as the Pax Britannica, which is to make sure that no Eurasian continental power emerges. Now, there's a great threat on the horizon. It's called BRICS. So it's entirely possible that you just leave these countries alone. Russia, India, and China would get together, and they would form a trade network that would unite the Eurasian continent. And if that were to happen, then America would lose access to Eurasia. It would lose access to Middle East. And America is sitting now on $37 trillion of debt. So then it would go bankrupt immediately. So what's happening in the Middle East, it is an existential crisis for America. It needs to control the Middle East in order to prevent this BRICS coalition from emerging. If Iran, Russia, and China became best friends, and they were able to trade peacefully, which would bring tremendous prosperity to the Eurasian continent, it would destroy the American empire. It would bankrupt America. It would probably force America to go into civil war. So we have to first and foremost remember that Israel is the pit bull of America. Nothing's happening without American approval. If Israel were to attack Iran in the next few days, next few weeks, it would be because America wants a conflict in the Middle East. That's something that we have to remember.
Yeah. And from the very beginning, Iran has said that it wasn't necessarily preparing for war, even fighting a war with just Israel, that it was fighting one and preparing for one with the United States. But yet you have, and I'm curious on what you think of this, Professor Zhang, because the way that we are being kind of fed information about the role of Israel in sparking this potential World War III nuclear situation vis-a-vis Iran is we're being fed this through people like intermediaries like Netanyahu, who are very boastful about Israel, who almost speak about Israel like the second coming of the United States' empire. Here is Netanyahu again on Ben Shapiro's show talking about just how much the United States needs Israel.
Well, I can tell you we shared it with America, but I can't share it with you. Okay? The most advanced offensive weapons on the planet, things that none of the superpowers have, developed by Israel, shared with America. Well, I can tell you we shared it with America.
So, Professor Zhang, he's basically saying this is the narrative you get, is that Israel is in fact in control because of how much the United States really needs it to achieve those objectives you were stating. What do you make of this, and how does it fit into things historically?
Look, I think you can make a very legitimate argument that Israel is in very much control of the American political apparatus. You know, AIPAC is the second most powerful lobby in America. Only the AARP, the pensioners, are more powerful than AIPAC. We also remember that there are like millions of pensioners, tens of millions of pensioners in America, and AIPAC is a very small organization. There just are not that many Jewish Americans. Yet at the same time, AIPAC has direct access to the White House. No matter who's in the White House, AIPAC is able to exert tremendous influence. You have, you know, it seems as though the media, the financial sector, it's controlled by Zionist interests. So yeah, you can make a very legitimate argument that Israel is controlled of the American political apparatus. At the same time, we have to remember that Netanyahu is very much an American creation. For the longest time, Netanyahu's patron was Sheldon Adelson, who is Jewish, but he's also American. So it was Sheldon Adelson who bankrolled Netanyahu's political career in Israel. And people don't understand this, but Netanyahu, he does not talk to Israeli media. He talks to American media. He refuses to talk to local Israeli media. You can't, if you're an Israeli journalist, you can't really book an interview with him. But Netanyahu is always available to talk to American media. And remember that Netanyahu grew up, he spent his formative teenage years in America. And you can make the legitimate argument that Netanyahu is an American asset, that he could very much be an American intelligence officer. I'm not saying he is, but I'm saying that if you were to make that assumption and you were to find evidence to support that claim, you could find a lot of evidence. So I think that Netanyahu coming out and saying that, you know, we Israel, we control America. The main reason why is that these empires do not like to be seen as bullies. You go back to the time of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire started all these wars around the world. You know, they basically burned down Carthage for no particular reason. But if you go back and look at their history, they always framed it as being provoked into war, as being peace-loving, but because of extenuating circumstances, because they were being threatened, because the opposing side threatened them, then no choice but to go to war. It's always, we had no choice but to go to war. If you look at American history, Americans believe the same thing. Every single war that happened overseas, whether it's the U.S.-Spanish War, whether it's World War I, it's World War II, they were always tricked or forced or manipulated into war. So I think that's just the way that Americans, the powers that be in America, like to frame things. America is peace-loving. It's a peace-loving empire. It's not even an empire. It's a republic. It's not an empire. And so when it goes to war, it's because someone tricked them to go to war. If the United States were to go to war against Iran this time around, it's not because the United States has geopolitical interests that must be protected. It's because Israel is out of control and Israel controls America. Or it's because Iran launched a ballistic missile against an air base in Qatar or American interests overseas, okay? They always need a pretext, and Israel provides a perfect pretext. So, you know, Netanyahu does no one any favors, especially his own people come on and saying that, oh, we control America. And he's been saying that for the past few decades.
You know, Professor Jiang, what's so interesting too is you had Israel attack Qatar and try to decapitate Hamas negotiators before Trump's so-called peace plan was put on the table. And then you have Trump give Qatar NATO-like security guarantees, which almost sets up a situation where the United States has a model now, a doctrine now, to defend with warfare all of these countries that surround Iran, which station U.S. military bases. And Iran has been very clear that these military bases are vulnerable should the United States go into war. And Iran sees Israel going to war with Iran as being a U.S.-driven war. So what do you make of this? How do you see this?
Yeah, I think that if you're an Iranian strategist, then you know you're being surrounded. So not only this treaty between the United States and Qatar, but also the treaty between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. We have to remember that Saudi Arabia and Iran are major geopolitical rivals. They've been rivals ever since 1979, revolution. They have different branches of Islam. You know, Iran is Shia and Saudi Arabia is Sunni. They both vie for supremacy of the Islamic world. They both sell oil, and they have economic, they are an economic rivalry. So Saudi Arabia very much would like to see Iran, the regime, fall and replace with a much more friendly regime. So there are all sorts of these pretexts in place. And when America does that, when America provides security guarantees all around the Middle East, right? So America is guaranteeing the security of Saudi Arabia, of Qatar, of Israel, then that sets a stage for a false flag attack, right? So Iran doesn't, even if Iran were to show tremendous restraint, and it has been showing tremendous restraint these past few years, if a false flag attack were to happen in Qatar or Saudi Arabia or Israel, then now the United States is forced to attack Iran in response.
Yeah, and already we see in the Kurdistan region on that part of Iran's border with Pakistan, I believe it is, we have seen our Iranian military forces be killed. So, and that's just within the hours and days of us talking here. So there is, that is how this began, right, Professor Jung? It began with a surprise attack, which actually was conducted inside of Iran. And even to this day, Israeli media, I believe it was Haaretz, which recently had an article talking about how Israel is waging an influence operation inside of Iran to try to conduct regime change.
Look, right now the Middle East, it's a lake of gasoline. All you need is a small spark to light the entire region up in fire. Look, the alliance has been drawn. Everyone's ready for war. Everyone's just waiting for the fuse to be lit. And I think it's going to happen very, very soon. Now, as to when it will happen, what's interesting for us to remember is that for the Israelis, for the Americans, this is just not a geopolitical rivalry. It is also an eschatological war. What I mean by that, and this is very important for your viewers to appreciate, is that there are these extremist religious elements that are both in the Israeli military and the American national security apparatus who see a war in the Middle East, World War III, as fulfillment of biblical prophecy, as the end of the world in order to rejuvenate the world. This is the end times. This is the end of days. And again, I don't think this is really appreciated, how the American national security apparatus is fully committed to igniting World War III in order to force the return of Jesus, the second coming. And these elements in the national security apparatus, I'm sure you've heard of them, right? They're the Mormons. They're the Freemasons. They are the Jesuits. They are a people called the Sabbatine Frankists, these extreme religious Jews. Okay, so there are different secret societies embedded with national security apparatus who all are following a certain script that requires them to start World War III in the Middle East. And once they start a war in the Middle East, then they're able to fulfill their different prophecies, which includes the creation of a world government, which includes the return of Jesus, which includes the arrival of the Jewish Messiah. Okay, so I don't think people really appreciate the eschatological elements, the extreme religious elements underlying this conflict in the Middle East. But I point this out because there's almost like an anxiety or a rush to get this war started as soon as possible. You know, it's insane.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as possible. And it almost feels like, as you said, Professor Jung, there is this tension built up that's not just about the realities on the ground, but it is about, I mean, we have a defense secretary of war now, Pete Hegseth, who is a crusader. I mean, he calls himself a crusader. This is his entire ideology is based on getting rid of Iran and, of course, China and the left and, you know, the sinners and whatever it is. But these are the kinds of people. And then we go into Christian Zionism. But ideology does drive these people. That the realities on the ground for them are almost secondary when it comes to their lust for war.
So, you know, 2-3 years ago, Israel imported 5 red heifers from Texas. These 5 red heifers were genetically modified to be perfect. And the reason why is the Bible says that you need to sacrifice a red heifer in order to consecrate the ground for the building of the temple. What this means is that Israel, the extreme religious fanatics in Israel, they want to build the third temple. This is problematic because they want to build it on top of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in the Islamic world. So if you think about it, this war between Israel and Iran, if it were to happen, it would provide the perfect pretext to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because then Israel can be like, oops, sorry, a ballistic missile came to Jerusalem and hit the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it's destroyed, but it's okay because we'll just build a third temple. And remember, if this would happen, if the Al-Aqsa Mosque were to be destroyed, then 1 billion Muslims around the world would be really just obligated to seek vengeance of some sort. It would be a cataclysm that is unimaginable right now.
Yeah, and say goodbye to those regimes in Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia. I mean, they would be put in an absolutely untenable situation for them. But Professor Zhang, how much of this then, you know, let's talk about the tension between the realities on the ground for a rabidly warmongering a state like Israel and the U.S. behind it, and their ideas for how they're going to do this, and what's actually going on. Because even Israeli media, that same media you've said, and I think quite accurately, Netanyahu won't speak to. Well, there might be a reason to, because actually Israeli media, for all of its flaws, and there's a lot of them, can be quite critical about what's going on in Israel's current direction. And so here's Ynet talking about Israel has won the battle but lost the war. And I just want to go to a particular quote here. All the very strategic, significant strategic achievements against Iran and Hezbollah have begun to fade because of deepening damage to Israel's international standing. The growing refusal of port workers, I think they're referring to Italy and other countries, to load cargo bound for Israel could have led to an unprecedented economic crisis. Another step toward collapse. Already, vital military equipment is not reaching Israel. And further in the article, before and after this, the author there talks about how there has been a kind of squandering of all of these supposed movements by Israel over the past 2 years in Gaza, Lebanon, etc., because the more that they win, quote unquote, the more that they continue to fight. So what do you make of this? Because I've heard you also make the argument that Israel relies upon kind of making itself into a quote unquote victim in order to achieve its aims. How do you see this fitting in to what's going on and some of the criticisms that Israel is facing and the challenges it's facing moving forward?
So I had a chance to visit Israel in 2010, in May 2020. I visited Israel in May 2012, and I visited Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa, and it's a very small country, right? About 8 million people when I visited. But it was extremely open, extremely cosmopolitan, extremely liberal, forward-looking, technologically impressive. So the Technion, which is their MIT, invited me and my students. I work in a school. We visited Israel, and they were extremely open, forthcoming. And I really saw Israel as the future of the Middle East. And fast forward to today, and right now, Israel is facing an identity crisis. You have two major factions in Israel. You have the Western-orientated, forward-looking, liberal cosmopolitans who live in Tel Aviv. And then you have these religious fanatics who want to fulfill biblical prophecy. And we have to remember that before October 7th, Netanyahu was really on the ropes. You got these massive protests against Netanyahu because Netanyahu wanted to change the structure of the Supreme Court, of the legal system. You had these millions of Israelis who came out to protest Netanyahu regime. And it really seemed as though Netanyahu's government was about to fall. And of course, October 7th happened. So that was very convenient for Netanyahu. And a lot of people say that if this war ever stops, if there's ever peace, then Netanyahu falls from government and he's put in jail for all his corruption these past few decades. So it's in Netanyahu's best interest to continue to fight. Now, Netanyahu's in power because he is supported fanatically by these religious extremists who believe that it is the end times, it's the end of days. Now, I'm not saying that these religious fanatics control Israel, but they see an opportunity to push their religious agenda in a time of turbulence. So, you know, there are many different factions that want to see this war in the Middle East, including the American military-industrial complex, the deep state, including financial interests, the City of London, Wall Street. So there are different interests aligned, and it's these religious extremists who are taking the lead in provoking a war. And they're the most vocal, the most energetic about it. And anyone could tell you, like, what's happening in Israel right now, it's not sustainable in the long term because, as you say, the economy is suffering because of the blockade, because of the death of tourism, because of like consumers are boycotting Israeli goods. Like, the economy is not sustainable. At the same time, you have to remember that Israel is fighting a war on 7-8 different fronts. I can't remember. I've lost track, okay? They're fighting a war everywhere. So it's not sustainable in the long term. But, you know, from a religious, eschatological worldview, this is a good thing because this is a test of true faith, because having faith is what gives you power. So one person with faith has more power than a million people without faith. They really do believe this. So what's happening in Israel, as the world turns against Israel, is actually galvanizing, energizing, unifying these religious extremists in Israel even to a greater extent. And so for them, they want to see this thing fulfilled. They want to see the thing finished to the end. And they will die for their belief. So even though there aren't that many of them, maybe, you know, a few hundred thousand, and millions of Israelis opposed to these people are willing to die for their beliefs. And they're forcing the world to turn against Israel, which then forces the Israelis to make a choice. Do you want to stand with these religious extremists and protect Israel? Or do you want to divide Israel and be conquered by, you know, the Gentiles, right? So they're not really giving the nation of Israel a choice. Ultimately, what's going to happen is those who do not like what's happening, those who are opposed to the religious fanaticism of Israel, they'll just get on a plane and leave because a lot of these people have, you know, foreign passports. And those who remain will unite behind these religious fanatics and fight a war to the end. So, you know, I visited Israel in 2012. I have tremendously fond memories of the Israeli people and the nation of Israel. But that Israel is dead. It's gone. And it's never coming back.
Yeah. And it seems like the roots of Israel, you know, many have been talking about the roots of Israel, colonialism, and what we've seen in Gaza is a huge kind of a climax to that, an extreme manifestation. And what you just said actually seems to be bearing out. We have thousands of Israelis actually leaving, thousands upon thousands. Some of the reasons are all the things that you said, economically. They're finding that it's not as vibrant as it once was. There's missiles coming, right? Yemen fires missiles. They have to go into the bunkers. There's this threat of war with Iran. That's constant. It's not so pleasant, especially after what happened during the 12-day war. But Professor Zhang, you know, you mentioned that Israel wants to unite itself by breaking the world, which appears also to be aligned with the U.S.'s strategy. Talk about how some of this fanaticism, how this because extremism definitely builds, the worse things get for a particular political and social order like the one Israel has. How does all of this fit together to compel Israel to even just double and triple down despite the major problems that it's going to face in the medium and long term?
Okay, so first of all, we have to remember that Israel, it's a Zionist project. It's not a Jewish project. And what I mean by that is, in the late 19th century, the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, when he published his book, Fatherland, and he promoted the idea of a return to Israel, or to found a Jewish nation, most Jews in the diaspora opposed this idea. Maybe there was 1% of Jews in Europe who thought that it would be a good idea to pack your bags, leave everything behind, and move to Uganda or Palestine. They had very comfortable lives in Britain, in France, in Germany. And so there was absolutely no consensus, or, you know, Jews didn't want to leave their countries. They were very comfortable in their countries. So in order for Zionists to happen, anti-Semitism had to be manufactured in some way. And so you can make the argument that these Zionists, and these Zionists could be Christian Zionists or, you know, Jewish Zionists, they had a vested interest in promoting anti-Semitism in Europe in order to create the state of Israel. Okay, and so there's a Israeli historian, Ilan Pape, who's written very thoroughly about this. And he's a historian based in Israel. And as you can imagine, he's very unpopular. But just logically thinking through, Zionism would not be possible without anti-Semitism. Now, another thing to remember is that after Israel was founded in 1948, it suffered a manpower problem. It didn't have that many people, and you needed laborers. Okay, so what's happening was that in Baghdad, where there was a very large Jewish diaspora, and they were very happy in Baghdad, it is rumored, or it is argued, that terrorist attacks, false flag attacks, occurred in Baghdad, which compelled the Jews to leave Baghdad for their own personal safety and go to Israel. So we have to remember that the founding of Israel is first and foremost based on anti-Semitism and also violent anti-Semitism. And so people in Israel have absolutely no problem with committing acts of violence in order to unify the nation of Israel. And this includes what's happening in Gaza today. If you look at what's happening in Gaza today, all this violence, all these atrocities are being live streamed to the world. And remember that Israel is one of the most technological savvy nations in the world. These Israeli entrepreneurs make billions of dollars doing these technological startups in America. So Israel has the technological capacity to blockade Gaza so that no information leaves Gaza. But Israel is choosing to let the Gazans live stream their own destruction. And we have to remember that 48% of everyone in Gaza are under the age of 18. So these are children being killed. So it's almost like ritual child sacrifice. And this is being live streamed to the world. So if you're just a human being and you know about this, you can't help but be disgusted by this. And you can't help but develop these very strong feelings about Israel. And what I think is that you can make the argument that this is all intentional. As anti-Semitism grows around the world, as it searches around the world, that's going to force Jews to unite around the nation of Israel. Jews around the world are being given a choice. Do you stand with Israel or do you stand with the world? But remember, the world has been persecuting you for millennia, okay? The world will eventually turn against you anyway. So come home, fight for Israel, and protect our faith and our God.
And it almost, you know, when you were talking there, Professor Jha, it almost seems unbelievable that, and a bit desperate to take this strategy, given that it seems like Western Jews, American Jews, it seems like Israel's actions are actually causing the exact opposite effect. But not only this, Professor Jha, but there's also what you call, and I'd like you to talk about this, the Dead River strategy, which kind of feeds into this cycle that now Israel finds itself in, which is creating so many problems at all levels, especially in achieving exactly what you just stated, which is to get the world to huddle around Israel, and especially to get Jews, especially in allied countries, to go along with its project. And I was thinking about Gaza. It's like, yeah, colonial powers have always done these kind of atrocities, always. Yeah. But at this point, it does feel like it is almost like a blood sport. It's almost like this is this is what you do in order to create the reaction that they're looking for. So any comments you have on all that?
Yeah, so, you know, if you look at a historical analogy, like why Israel is doing this, well, there are two analogies. The first analogy are the Aztecs. So as people know, before the Aztecs went to war, they committed human sacrifice. It was a way to channel their god and energize their people because, you know, sacrifice, human sacrifice, it's taboo. Like everyone knows this is a bad thing. And everyone knows that if you do this sort of thing, if you break a taboo, then your enemies will feel free to kill you in any way. Okay, so you leave your people no option but to fight to the death, because if you don't fight to the death, your enemies will kill you anyway. Okay, so that's the first analogy. Second analogy is, if you look at Chinese military stratagems throughout the millennia, it's a very common tactic is the, as you say, the Dead River tactic. And the idea is, let's just say in a land battle, your enemy has overpowered you. Now you're forced to retreat and your troops are running, they're divided, their morale is low. So as a general, your best option in this circumstance is to direct your troops, the line of retreat, to a river. Okay? Why? Because once the troops gather in the river, you can now unify them. You can give them like a pep rally. You can rally them and tell them, look, here's your option. You can either go in the river and drown, or you can come together as a people, come together as a force and fight with one will and beat a fist to smash your enemy. And given that choice, your troops will feel galvanized and they'll rally behind your flag and they'll fight the enemy. And what's remarkable is that this strategy does work. The acts like human sacrifice, it does work. And the Dead River tactic, it does work. Another tactic is to burn your ships. And when your troops see the ships being burned, they know that, okay, there's no escape, so I need to fight to the end. So that very much is a strategy or the mentality that Israelis are adopting in this time. They know the struggle is not Gaza. I mean, Gazans have no, can't resist, okay? It's just a sacrifice. The real enemy is Iran. So you need to rally your people to prepare for this conflict with Iran, which will be cataclysmic. If you think that what's happening to the Israel economy is bad right now, imagine what will happen when Iran starts raining drones and ballistic missiles on Israel every single day. What happened when the Houthis, the Hezbollah, they're fully activated and they start blockading the coast of Israel? The economy is going to plummet. People are going to be forced to seek shelter underground every single day. And at that point, people need to feel as though they have no choice in the matter. They have to fight. They have to fight to the death. I also point out, this is very important, there's an eschatological element to what's happening. Remember all these different secret societies, they're trying to fulfill biblical prophecy. Now, biblical prophecy states that before the end of the world, what will mark the end of the world and the return of Jesus or the arrival of Messiah is the world will fight Israel in the war of Gog and Magog. And in this war, it will seem as though Israel is being destroyed, that all Jews will die. They will fall to the sword. But the very last minute, when all hope is lost, then God will intervene. So it's almost as though there's a script in place. And the Israeli, these Israeli religious fanatics and their Christian Zionist allies in America, they're trying to follow the script to the letter. So you see the surge of anti-Semitism in the internet right now. And look, people aren't stupid. People are able to differentiate Zionism from Judaism. These are not the same thing, right? And people can be anti-Zionist while being anti-Semitic. So why are these things being conflated? Well, I think they're being conflated on purpose. I think that there are these bad actors in online, so these influences in the media. I won't name names, okay? But you all know who they are. They know that the script requires for anti-Semitism to surge in the world. And so they're conflating Zionism with Judaism, all right? So it's unfortunate that anti-Semitism is surging around the world, but that's part of the script. That's part of the plan, to force all Jews to return to Israel and initiate the war of Gog and Magog. And in the Battle of Armageddon, when all hope seems lost, then biblical prophecy will be fulfilled.
Yeah. And, you know, Professor Zhang, given your comments, there has been news almost materializing what you're saying here. I don't know if you saw this, but Israel actually, in a new FARA filing, has just hired a California firm to conduct the largest Christian church geofencing campaign in U.S. history in order to target evangelical churchgoers with pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian messaging. And it's actually quite incredible. There's a record now of Israel stalking American Christians while they attend church. And here it is, a geofencing and Christian targeting campaign used in history, using digital tools to identify and show pro-Israel messaging to U.S. Christians, target Christians who attend any U.S. megachurch in target markets. And the website compiles pro-Israel pastoral resources, social media posts, earned and bought media. I mean, this is, and it goes on and on about the goals, reaching out to these churches, working with them, collecting information. I mean, a virtual reality 10/7 experience, designing trailers, set designers, all of this to win back. They're saying, I didn't have it up. Sorry about that, everyone. So I just want to go back actually to this. This is the main post. This is the Education in Israeli Information campaign that just came out of a FARA filing. Comment on this, Professor Zhang, and I'll show more of it, because I did not share it to the screen. So comment on what, how this fits into what you were just saying.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, Israel's best friends in America are the Christian Zionists. And there are different groups of Christian Zionists. So the largest is an organization called Christians United for Israel, run by John Hagee. It's 7 million people. And, you know, Christian Zionists, if you take a much more open-ended definition, it's tens of millions of people in America. So that's why the Zionist lobby is so powerful. Yes, the Zionist money has access to the money of billionaires. What really matters are these religious fanatics in the Christian Zionist movement, especially the evangelicals, who will call the representatives every single day and demand, why are you not helping Israel more? So this is the best weapon that Israel has in America. These tens of millions of Christian Zionists who will call their representatives every single day, who will camp outside the representative's office in order to make sure the representatives are doing whatever is necessary to support Israel. And these Christian Zionists are much more likely to join the military and fight for Israel than other people as well. Because remember, at the end of the day, what really matters, what really pushes political prophecy forward is an American ground invasion of Iran. Israel needs to knock Iran out of power, and it needs to knock America out of the Middle East. So what people don't appreciate is the biblical prophecy, America is not involved, okay? China's not involved. These two great superpowers, China and America, are not part of biblical prophecy. And so they both need to be occupied somewhere else in order for biblical prophecy to come into fruition, to be completely fulfilled. So this is all part of a much larger script. And these Christian Zionists are fanatical about achieving this prophecy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like it just keeps on getting worse and worse. Professor Zhang, your last thoughts before we move on to another front of this World War III scenario. Your final thoughts on this overall situation. It does feel like, despite all of, and you mentioned, you know, Gaza, people in Gaza, Palestinians don't have the ability to resist. What's so interesting is that they cannot resist the killing. We've seen that, the genocide, it's the atrocities. But Israel has had a hard time with those who do resist. They're unable to stop them. They're unable to stop forces like Hamas and things like this. And at the same time, they're doubling and tripling down on fanaticism to try to win back a world. They're even talking about that targeting the evangelicals. That's one part of it. They're even talking about TikTok and Larry Ellison and all, helping them out to misinform people all around the world and to try to target Americans and Westerners who have been brainwashed to be pro-Palestinian. It does reek of desperation. What are your final thoughts on this, as an Iran war does feel right around the corner?
Yeah, so that's a great point, Danny. And I completely agree. So it seems as though these Christian Zionists, are in complete control, because they can control the American national security apparatus. They're billionaires. They control Silicon Valley. They're able to dictate policy. What we've seen these past few months is the narrative is not holding up. They're not able to do whatever they want because people are resisting. And it seems as though the script is falling apart because people are not cooperating, right? So, for example, the Charlie Kirk assassination. Well, the plan was to use that assassination to recruit people for the military, for the U.S. military, to send off to war in the Middle East. The NBC News report this. NBC News report that the Pentagon had planned to use the Charlie Kirk assassination in order to recruit more troops for its wars, for its planned wars in the Middle East. And what was amazing is the moment that the Pentagon reported this, there's a massive rebellion, armed rebellion, and the Pentagon realized this was not going to hold up. That if they did this, then this would be counterproductive. And in fact, what's amazing is people are waking up that, like, the Charlie Kirk assassination is not what it appears to be. People are now suspicious, they're skeptical, they're thinking for themselves. This is not part of the script. And rather than engaging in reflection and recognizing that people cannot be easy as fooled as, say, in 9/11 or before, as you say, these Christian Zionists, these Zionist forces are doubling down, right? So Larry Ellison buying up TikTok, it was not a strategic move. It was an act of desperation. It is not in the best interest of the Zionist movement, of the Zionists, to be out in the public like this, right? But not only did Larry Ellison buy up TikTok, but his son has appointed Barry Weiss to be editor-in-chief of CBS News. It's not strategic to do something like that. You do not want your allies out in front. You don't want to be visible. Power is most powerful when it is invisible, when it is hidden in the shadows. All right. So this tells us that people are now waking up. There's this great global awakening where the average person is able to understand how power works and how being propelled by a fanatical few that have absolutely no interest in the betterment of humanity. And so I think that like what's been happening, yes, okay, we're moving towards war in the Middle East. But the fact that your average citizen is able to recognize the hypocrisy, the cynicism of these people, it's a sign of hope, I think.
Yeah, for sure. You know, Professor Zhang, World War III being so, you know, some say, and I've argued on this channel, actually, that World War III is kind of this ongoing process yep. that is already underway. But mm-hmm. of course, there's going to be a larger conflagration. There's no doubt about this. And you have Europe, you have NATO. And when we look at the Ukraine conflict side, I think it's important to go over this. They are talking like they are preparing for World War III. Oh, sorry about that. You see here, a former minister of Lithuania, I believe it is. Yes, Lithuania. Get these countries confused. Is facing its Pearl Harbor moment and is calling directly to confront Russia militarily for NATO to do it, as it supposedly provokes NATO with drones. And this has been an ongoing story of so-called Russian escalation around its drones. But then there's the bigger issue, Professor Zhang. There is the Tomahawks. Ukraine preparing for delivery of Tomahawk missiles. Now, Donald Trump has said he's made some kind of decision about these, but you have the Telegraph here, British media, basically admitting that this is happening, but it's going to take a while. It's going to take months, and there's going to be a kind of escalation ladder because Ukraine can't fire them. But one of the interesting things, points that it makes, is that it shows how far these Tomahawks can go if Ukraine ever gets around to being able to fire them. It can go actually a range of 1,500 miles, and it can harbor nuclear warheads, which means it can go beyond the point of Moscow. And Vladimir Putin has said that this would be a major escalation in the conflict and essentially ruin relations with the United States. Where do you see the World War III scenario in the world, Professor Zhang, on this particular question, because Russia and NATO have been at war for over 2 years now.
Yep.
3 years.
So I completely agree with your analysis. I completely agree that, like, in Ukraine, Russia's not fighting Ukraine only, it's fighting NATO. I will also say that NATO has already lost this war, right? Because these past two, three years, NATO has been fighting an ideal war. Right, it's not using its manpower. It's using Ukrainian manpower, but it's providing targeting. It's providing intelligence. It's providing financing. It's providing weapons. It's providing special forces. Right. So when this Crimean bridge gets blown up, it's not the Ukrainians doing this. They don't have the technology. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the expertise. They don't have the weapons. It's NATO that's doing this. All right. So, and that's what NATO does really well. NATO does these shadow wars, aerial bombardment, really, really well. And so these past 2 years, NATO has been fighting the ideal war to use Ukrainian proxies, but then use NATO strategy. And it's been a complete disaster for both Ukraine and for NATO. These counteroffensive that Ukraine has been launching has been disastrous for Ukrainians. It's estimated that Ukrainians have lost between 1 to 2 million men in this war. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's actually a lot of people, because these are your best fighters. These are your most motivated fighters. And now Ukraine is forced to recruit people randomly off the streets. And that's why you have these massive desertions in the Ukrainian army. So the war is done. It really is. If you just look at what's happening on the front lines, Ukrainians are not able to hold the front lines. So in August, there's this Provost breakthrough where these Russians launch these probing attacks, and they discovered the Ukrainian defense are very weak. And the Ukrainian response, it's very telling because the Ukrainians actually had to redeploy forces from elsewhere to stopgap that breakthrough. All right. So militarily speaking, that's a disaster. When you're forced to redeploy forces, when you're forced to move forces around, that's going to exhaust your troops in the long term. And so the entire strategy is not sustainable. So just from a military perspective, Ukraine has lost the war. Now, what's interesting is that because Ukraine has lost the war, NATO is going to double down because NATO cannot afford to lose the war. NATO has invested too much into the war. If NATO were to sign a peace agreement with Putin right now, Britain, France, Germany would all go bankrupt the next day because they've invested billions of dollars into this war. They expect that this war will be won and they will have access to all these Ukrainian rare earth minerals. They'll be able to steal basically Russia's $200 billion that they've frozen. Okay. So they've got all like this. They live in fairyland. Okay. They believe that this war will be won at any day. And once this war is won, they'll be able to recoup their losses. They'll be able to impose sanctions on Russia to a greater degree. So now that the war has been lost, the only option for NATO is to double down. And so what we're seeing is a movement towards full NATO involvement in Ukraine. So some things that I will point out to you is the recent Moldova elections, where a very pro-European politician, Sandu, won thanks to these overseas ballots. So you can imagine the shenanigans involved with that. But why Moldova is important is that Moldova can seek to provoke Russia by maybe besieging Transnistria, which is Russian territory. Then you have Kaliningrad as well. And NATO has talked about besieging Kaliningrad. Okay, Romania, these past few days, have basically drafted a law that compels young men to be drafted, basically. So slowly, NATO countries are moving towards a draft, and they have no choice in the matter but to send ground troops to Ukraine to reinforce the front lines. But as I say, this war is lost. All these men that are going to Ukraine are going to die. The reason why is that what Russians do really well is artillery warfare. And the situation is set up that Russia can slowly advance and control all of eastern Ukraine, and there's very little that NATO can do about it. These Tomahawk missiles, they are an escalation, but at the end of the day, because Russia has nuclear weapons, there's very little that NATO can do except send its troops to die. But unfortunately, because of the capture, because it's Americans that control the European military apparatus, then that's exactly what's going to happen. The Europeans are going to draft a young man to go off to Ukraine to die. And unfortunately, there's nothing that anyone can do about this.
And, Professor Zhang, you've talked about Vladimir Putin himself being an Ubermensch. And I'd like you to talk about what that means in the context of some comments he made at the Valdai conference, which he uses as an occasion to speak very candidly for hours. I mean, he does this on several occasions, almost every year. Speaks several hours to an international audience, journalists, academics, etc., about everything and anything. And he did make comment on what this all means, that the Tomahawk situation. And I want an escalation, and I want to just play that quickly, just a piece of these remarks, and to foreground your analysis on Putin, the Ubermensch. Here we go.
They can. We'll be shooting them down and improving our airborne. We'll be shooting the Tomahawks harm us? They can. We'll be shooting them down and improving our air defense systems. Will this damage our relations with the U.S., which are now seeing some light at the end of the tunnel? Of course it will. But how could it be otherwise? Using Tomahawks without the direct participation of American military personnel is impossible. This would mark a completely new, qualitatively new stage of escalation, including relations between Russia and the United States.
So, Professor Zhang, yeah, I'm definitely want our audience to understand what you meant by Vladimir Putin as an Ubermensch in this stage of history, and how his responses to escalations, like the Tomahawk, I mean, this isn't the first go around with escalations of strikes on Russian soil. So talk about this.
Yeah, so what I mean is that Putin is a master strategist. He's the only world leader out there today that's able to see all of geopolitics, the grand scheme of geopolitics. He's able to make maneuvers, very slight, very nuanced maneuvers that put Russia in a much better advantage, okay? So I'll just list some examples. His invasion of Ukraine was a stroke of genius, and it was extremely brave and insightful. Because remember, before the invasion of Ukraine, people only remember the 2003 US-Iraq war. And so what was embedded in people's imagination is the invincibility and inevitability of the American empire. No power in the world can challenge America. And that's why we have to buy US dollars. Even though, you know, America is now, you know, $37 trillion in debt, we're forced by the US dollar because there's no other game in town, right? If you don't play along, America can come and invade you because they have special forces and they have the complete control over the internet. And so you have actually no choice but to play along. And Putin's invasion of Ukraine, it was justified, but more importantly, it was a signal to the world that it is possible to stand up against America. And there's very little America can do about it. Putin, by attacking Ukraine, signaled to the world that America is really a paper tiger. Remember that after the invasion of Ukraine and after the fact that America couldn't really do anything about it, right? You had these African nations sort of rebel against the Pax Americana, against the European nations, and they seek greater autonomy. So it was a signal to the entire world that you don't have to be oppressed by the Pax Americana anymore. You can stand up for your national sovereignty. So I would say that's a stroke of genius. Another stroke of genius is to ally himself with Iran. Putin understands that ultimately there's a conflict between the United States and Iran. That's the ultimate conflict. Like what's happening in Ukraine is important, but the real conflict, the real test of the Pax Americana will be the conflict in Iran. And as a result, Putin has been helping Iran bolster its air defenses. And it's been providing a lot of support to Iran. So what makes Putin so genius is that he doesn't involve himself everywhere. Like Trump involves himself everywhere, and Trump talks too much. Putin understands what are the pivotal points in this geopolitical game and what he needs to do in order to exercise maximum leverage over these points. And he's able to articulate in a way that unifies his people. If you just go and look at the front lines of Ukraine, the soldiers are extremely energetic. They really believe, like this war in Ukraine, it's really a war for human civilization. It's really a war for the soul of humanity. They believe that Russia's civilization is the Antichrist. So Putin has been able to rally his people to achieve a civilizational goal. And that's what makes him a remarkable figure. And historians, when they look back and they study this time, they will all say the person who killed the American empire was Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting, Professor Zhang, because as you were talking about how Putin has approached all of this, and how Russia has approached what has been perhaps before Israel-Iran really kicked off in June 2025, what was well known as the catalyst of a World War III scenario exploding. But as Russia has been preparing for this, upgrading its military and advancing in so many technological innovations on that front, from the Oreshnik to so many other things. This is what you have the United States preparing for. Inside a secret bunker 2,000 feet underground, should World War III come. And of course, this is the Economic Times, so this is basically a very, very, very Trump-affiliated media outlet. But here it is. It's Cheyenne Mountain has 2,000 feet below it, fully equipped to withstand nuclear attacks, a bunker, and it shows just how seriously the U.S. takes the possibility of global conflict. But Professor John, you know, there's a lot made. I know you've made videos about the United States being almost like anti-civilization and the decline of the United States as an empire, very rapid decline, mind you. How does this all fit with this escalation toward World War III, whether it's on the Russia front, Iran front, or otherwise? You have the United States very much, at least at this elite level, preparing for that.
Look, when empires decline, they decline not because they face a superior foe. That never happens. Empires decline because of internal factors. So elite overproduction, right? You have too many people vying for very few slots of power, bureaucratization. So the American empire, it's lost its capacity to be strategic, to be forward-looking, to be open. It's very much mired in bureaucratic thinking. So it's passive, it's reactive. And so America is sleepwalking into war in Iran. Europe is sleepwalking into war in Ukraine. If these people had any strategic capacity, they would seek immediate peace with Vladimir Putin. Because Vladimir Putin has been very explicit. He says, listen, I'm always willing to negotiate peace. If I just have my four oblasts and security guarantees, and if Ukraine promises never to join NATO, I'll be perfectly willing to sign a peace treaty, right? Perfectly reasonable. And NATO and the United States should do that. But they won't do that because of some cost fallacy, because they felt that, no, we're still the empire, and we're not going to be bullied by Putin, even though he's beating the crap out of us. So that's the real danger right now, where the Western world, especially NATO and the United States, there's no leadership. It's all reactive. It's all passive. I'm not sure if you've seen the movie Dr. Strangelove, okay? But Dr. Strangelove is really a documentary. It really reveals to you how people in power in America think, okay? So in Dr. Strangelove, there's a real threat of nuclear war. So the president and his generals, they get together and they say, what do we do? And their solution is, oh, we'll go and we'll build bunkers. We'll turn these mines into bunkers. We'll hide there and we'll have like these sex harems and wait out the war. Okay? They're all selfish. They're all narrow-minded. They're all arrogant. They all suffer from hubris. And so that's what's happening in America. Rather than say, okay, wow, this war in Iran, that's going to happen. This war in Ukraine, it could all lead to the end of humanity. All they care about is protecting their own privileges. Okay? That's all they care about. How do I protect my own power in this bureaucracy? If you look at the Pentagon right now, I think like you have like 40, almost 40 four-star generals. And combat soldiers, you have like about over a million. In World War II, you had 6 or 7 four-star generals for about 10 million people, for 10 million combat soldiers. So the American Pentagon, the American bureaucracy, the Washington, D.C., it's bloated. You've got all these people in power with extreme privileges. And all they're interested in is maintaining their privileges. And these are bureaucrats. All they do is sit in their office and do nothing all day. They're not accountable to the people. Like, their job doesn't actually require them to, like, do anything constructive. And that's why you have this tremendous bad policymaking in the Middle East and in Ukraine.
Yeah, no, all good points. It's astounding to watch, Professor Zhang, because you have On the one hand, the United States is decadent empire, which is just fueled by just the most rapacious profiteering in every sector, everywhere. I think you said in another show, just the massive amounts of debt that everyone is in the United States is a testament to this, just how dominant finance and monopoly really is in the U.S. And yet, you see the consequences of this militarily, threatening with these tomahawks. Many experts have said these are very old weapons. And how does the United States protect NATO from obliteration if Russia decides to strike back with very fast, very big missiles like the Oreshnik? But Professor Zhang, there's also this bigger geopolitical situation I want you to comment on, because as you were speaking, it made me think of this comment that Trump made to Tucker Carlson on his campaign before he became president of the United States for the second time. This is what he said to Tucker Carlson about Russia-China. And that's not even talking about Russia-Iran, because oftentimes all the U.S. is doing with Russia-Iran through its media, through its political arm, is bashing this relationship as insignificant. But here is what Trump said about Russia and China.
This Russia was a major hoax. Okay, it's now been adjudged to be a total major hoax. We had the Mueller commission. We had everybody. It was a hoax. It was made up to justify why Hillary Clinton lost the election when she wasn't supposed to lose. It was made up by Schiff and Hillary and some other just total sleazeballs. And what happened is the fake news media, which is back there, you do know that. They're always around someplace. But what happened is the fake news media, what they said is it started with a simple move. How did you lose the election? Myself, wait a minute, okay, I won this election.
This is the wrong video, but there is a video that's circulating in the same interview where he talks about Biden's biggest disaster was uniting Russia and China by going on Russia, and making U.S. foreign policy strictly about Russia. Talk about your comments on that, because the Russia-China relationship is stronger than it's ever been, and many people say this is a result of a U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, well, I think like this example shows that the president of the United States doesn't have any real power. And this is something that Vladimir Putin said to Tucker Carlson in their interview together. Vladimir Putin just said that we got to this point in Ukraine over decades because Vladimir Putin made many overtures to past presidents, including Bill Clinton, right? Vladimir Putin wanted to join NATO. And Clinton's like, of course you can join NATO. And then the next day, Clinton's like, oops, I talked to my superiors. He didn't use these words, okay? But basically he said, I talked to my superiors and they said no. So the president of the United States is not in charge. The military industrial complex, the deep state, they're in charge. And that's why Vladimir Putin said in his interview with Tucker Carlson, that's why I don't bother talking to US presidents anymore, because they don't really matter. And what matters to the deep state is continuous war, because that's how they profit. Right. So Julian Assange said it best. The point is not to win wars. The point is to have wars, to have continuous wars, because that's how you profit. That's how you steal from the American people. Like what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Iraq, was that the military industrial complex was able to steal trillions and trillions of dollars from American taxpayers. And it came at the cost of the destruction of both Afghanistan and Iraq. So that's a setup now. The setup is not to have wars that you can win that benefit the American people and that extend the power of the American empire. The point is to have wars that allow you to steal continuously from the empire.
Yeah. And finally, Professor Zhang, do you buy the assertion that the United States now, given that it still is very much deep into the Ukraine conflict, even escalating it to the point of talking about tomahawks, which is what many experts on this show have said is a strategic weapon, as you said, lack of strategy, but it's a strategic weapon that's supposed to be used in the most dire of circumstances. So handing these off to Ukraine would send this very big message. But the national security strategy of the United States supposedly hasn't come out yet, but there have been rumors that it's shifting to the Western Hemisphere, shifting to Latin America, Venezuela being the most notable target right now. And of course, the homeland, which I guess means immigration, militarization, we've seen that, even using the U.S. as a training ground. But do you buy this as being the so-called strategy, given that the United States is on the cusp of a war with Iran, mired in a war with Russia, and still very much stationed in and around Asia?
So I think you're right. I think it's very hard to believe American policymakers. It doesn't seem as though they have strategy. It doesn't seem as though they're able to plan ahead. I think they are serious about the national defense priorities. I think the main priority is to create a rapprochement with China. Because remember, this war in Ukraine, it's just going to escalate. This war in the Middle East, it's going to happen sooner or later. So does the United States want to have another conflict in the South China Sea? Does it really want a conflict with China? And the answer is obviously no, right? So I think this national defense priorities, it's a signal to China that the United States is willing to negotiate terms with China. And it could be something along the lines of, you know, greater economic cooperation in return for the United States declaring that it will never support Taiwanese independence. And it could be something along those lines. But I do believe in the next 3 months, because all these conflicts elsewhere, because all these flashpoints elsewhere, Trump will visit China and there'll be a major rapprochement between China and the United States. So I think this national defense priorities is really a signal to China and to the world that the United States is very interested in peace terms with China.
And then finally, Professor John, given what you just said, then what does that say? Because you said that NATO's already lost the war with Russia, which is essentially the U.S. losing that war, given that the United States controls NATO, or at least is at the head of NATO, despite its attempts under Trump to distance itself politically, rhetorically, etc. But then what does that say about this overall foreign policy picture? Because you have this brewing war with Iran, which you've analyzed, and you can definitely talk about this as being a potential disaster for the United States militarily, given if it has to move further up the escalation ladder to even a direct invasion or a more direct conflict with Iran. And then, of course, China, which not too long ago, the United States was talking very bellicose, and still today, many people in high places in the United States, foreign policy was talk very aggressively about China. But there has been a difficulty for the Trump administration in particular in setting its focus on any one of these things. And now it seems like they've opened up another front to the so-called Western Hemisphere. It's a very chaotic situation. So your final comments on the overall situation of the U.S. empire vis-a-vis Russia and all of these fronts, given your analyses in recent weeks and years in your work.
Yeah, I think that what we'll see is that no matter what conflict the United States gets into, and it could be an invasion of Iran, it could be an invasion of Venezuela, okay? No matter what conflict the United States gets into, people will be surprised by how incompetent the American military is. The American military looks great on paper, but fighting a war is very hard. It requires tremendous logistics. It requires tremendous sacrifice. And if you just go to YouTube and you just look at life on these American carriers, all right, it's like a 5-star hotel. I've watched YouTube videos of life on American carriers, and they have access to like great food. It's like a buffet every day. It's a great life to be in the American military. And that's great for peace times, but in war, soldiers are required to make the necessary sacrifice necessary to win this war. So the example, of course, are the Houthis in Yemen. They're poor, they don't have access to modern weapons, and they're beating the crap out of the Americans. So it's not about your weaponry, it's not about your technology. It's not about how much money you have. It's really about your dedication, your capacity to make sacrifices to win this war. The Houthis have demonstrated that they are willing to make these sacrifices. And quite honestly, I don't know if the American military servicemen are willing to make these sacrifices to win the war, because quite honestly, there's no reason for America to win a war. Like, who cares what happens in the Middle East? Who cares what happens to Ukraine? America is a self-sufficient nation that has been self-sufficient for centuries. And it doesn't really need the rest of the world. So the American people are like, why are we embroiled in these forever wars overseas? So I think it would be the greatest thing for the world and for the American people, for the American empire to come to an end.
Yeah, 100% agree with you there. And just to close it, you know, this segment, the United States, to say it's impossible for the United States to go to war like it has at any other point in the past, Iraq, Afghanistan, Korea, Vietnam, everything in between, I think would be an understatement. People in the United States, they really don't care. They really don't want to. There's a reason why recruiting numbers are down. There's a reason why the U.S. is having such a struggle keeping people in the military. The Trump administration, ironically, might be making it worse, regardless of whatever people think about identity politics and all of this. Regardless of that, just to go after certain people because of how they dress or how they look or whatever, this, it only shrinks the pool. It only shrinks the pool. This pool only gets smaller if you go after particular segments of the population. So the U.S. is definitely in trouble, and you're 100% right, Professor Zhang. The world will be a much better place should the empire, when the empire, I should say, falls. But this was a great conversation, Professor Zhang. I have your Predictive History YouTube channel in the video description. Is there anything you'd like to plug before we head out of here?
Yeah, so I really want to plug my Substack. My Substack is also called Predictive History, and in it, you'll find more of my geopolitical analysis. So definitely subscribe to my Substack if you want to know more about how I think about geopolitics.
Yes, and I will right now put that in the video description as well, so people can, it is now saved there, so people can check that out. Everyone, hit the like button before you go. That will help boost the stream, boost the video as we end here and, you know, as it enters the YouTube sphere. For replay, definitely go to the video description to find Professor Zhang's work. You can also find all the places to support this channel, Patreon, Substack, and so much more to support and follow the work there. I will be back in a couple of days with a panel of geopolitical analysts, Scott Ritter, Ray McGovern, many others. So be on the lookout for that announcement. And without further ado, everybody, take care. We'll hopefully be seeing Professor Zhang on this channel for many more times to come. Thanks so much again, Professor Zhang.
Thank you.
All right, we're heading out of here. Thanks for all the super chats. Thanks for all the new members. And thank you to all the moderators. We're out. Bye-bye.